Welcome to Deeply Disturbing Things,
the podcast.
I'm Macy.
And I'm Naomi.
And we're two anxious counselors that like to talk about deeply disturbing things.
This is our therapy.
Join us.
Dive in.
Episode 99. Was there a reason you just put your fingers into your sake?
That was totally like misjudge of spatial relations.
I thought it was like some cultural thing I didn't know about. am I supposed to dip my fingers?
I reached for it and I misjudged and I overshot the grabbing of the sake cup and my fingers went in.
You made it look really casual. I thought it was just
a luckily little... I had just washed my hands emerging from the restroom as I just did a while ago. Kanpai.
Hi, we really enjoyed the sake last time, so we're going again.
We're going again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yummy.
So we went on a little adventure today. We went to the
Asian world. I took Macy to Asian world for the first time.
In Spokane, there's a store that has all the Asians in it.
Because that's Spokane.
It's the world of Asians.
Because Spokane in general can't really differentiate. And so it's just Asian world.
They have some good food in there, though.
Yeah, we got some good snacks.
Yeah. So it kind of brings me up to one of my check-in things that I wanted to bring up to you, because I know we chit-chatted a little bit about it, but the increase in violence in the Asian world.
Yes, there has been a very concerning uptick in violence towards Asian individuals in this country. And I heard in Seattle that that's going on over there too. So I haven't heard about it in Spokane, but Seattle is, you know, our state. Yeah. And so last week when we podcasted, that was the day that the shooting happened in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I had thought kind of about saying something, but I felt like it was just like too close to home at that moment. And I didn't really know how to approach it.
And then I talked to you and said, hey, I think you need to approach this because it seems better than me approaching it, who has no real context.
Yeah, I mean, there's been like an underlying upsetness that I've had and definitely some increased vigilance just going about my daily life, which sucks. But I actually wrote a little essay today
in preparation
because I knew you were going to bring it up.
Yeah.
But look at my writing, how bad it is.
You're like a child.
No, it's so bad. So usually I can't even read my own writing. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So
I have scribble handwriting too.
I wrote a short essay about why the Atlanta murderers were a hate crime.
Because because it didn't get ruled like not.
Well, the FBI has not found like evidence or deemed it. But here are my thoughts. This is just my thoughts. People can settle down. Why the Atlanta murders were.
Do you want to explain what those were in case, like, just a quick overview?
Was it last Thursday?
I think it was last
I think it was
week.
The day of our podcast.
Yeah.
So 8 people were shot by an individual and 6 of them were Asian women. And they were at 3 different spas, I believe, in the Atlanta red light district. I think that's the synopsis.
Yes.
Okay, let's see if I can read my writing. So the shooter was familiar with the victims as he was a regular customer at the spas. He blamed them for his problems with sex addiction and murdered them in a calculated assault. These Asian women were his intended targets. There is a long history with Asian women being hypersexualized and fetishized. Part of the reason the Asian women are working in this industry is because of the opportunity created by this stereotype.
I had somebody once I forget how old I was, but somebody who was interested in dating me, but ended up dating my friend because she was Asian. And he it disclosed to me that he was specifically attracted to the quote, Asian look. That was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That my little brain didn't understand at the time. Like, what do you mean?
The shooter likely bought into this stereotype as well, either implicitly or explicitly, as a frequent customer. He may not have explicitly stated something like, I hate Asians and want to kill them, but his actions speak for him. And that is why the Atlanta murders were a hate crime. And I feel like this is similar to the Pulse massacre,
mm-hmm.
that was not labeled a hate crime either, even though
it was a targeted specific population group.
Well, it targeted not only the LGBTQ community, but mm-hmm. the Latinx community. And that was mm-hmm. deemed terrorism, which yeah. pulls focus from those communities that were affected.
Yeah.
So those are my thoughts. Yeah. My essay.
Well, thank you for sharing.
On the back of my mail, as you can see.
Thank you for sharing.
Because I want to save paper.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for touching on it.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
It felt good to write my thoughts down because they've just been this jumble of emotion, and then mm-hmm. to like have to organize it and to present it in my little 3-paragraph essay.
That was good.
It felt good. I felt like, okay, it's down on the paper. This is where I stand. This is what I believe. I wrote it.
I approve of your message. So we have been preparing. I actually got here 2 hours early. And we have a special surprise for everybody for our next episode. This is episode 99 right now. Episode 100
is the next one
by our
calculations.
And that's not including the two ghost episodes that never aired.
We've lost about 4 episodes altogether over the years.
Has it been 4?
Yeah.
I think it has. That sucks. Because we never actually kept track of that, so we could reuse those topics.
Yeah. No, I did. I repeated one of mine.
Remember? I didn't. You just said that I never did that one. I'm wondering if it's a ghost episode one.
It might be a ghost episode.
Yeah. But I can't say it now in case I want to use it. So we have a good surprise for everybody. And we can't tell you. That's all. It's a secret. It's a good secret.
But I cannot keep good secrets. It's so hard for me. So can I just say a hint?
Sure. Go ahead.
It involves red string.
It does involve red string. And I would like to say I tried to compromise initially without red string, and it wasn't possible.
You have to have the red string.
So that's all we can tell you
now. The red string ties it all together.
Yes. So tune in next time and right now, but next time for our 100th special episode.
We are legit podcasters at this point.
It's crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
And I love how you came over here 2 hours early. We had all the time in the world, and yet we found ourselves scrambling
the last five minutes.
Like, oh shit, we have to start in 1 minute.
Yeah, we were late. We were 2 minutes.
Yeah, because we were outside trying to take a photo.
Yeah, and we'll see how that turns out. Yeah, so I think that's it for my check-in. That's it, I think.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I don't have anything either.
Your hair is blue in it and mine has red in it. We're so patriotic.
And we didn't even plan that.
No.
I love it. And you can actually see the blue this time. I insisted
mm-hmm.
that it be something that is visible and not just imaginary.
Yeah, yeah. You get to go first.
Okay.
I'm so excited for my topic today.
I'm so excited about mine.
I have this weird feeling that you have my same topic. I don't think you do.
Mine links to my last week's topic.
Then no.
Okay.
I don't remember, but I'm going to just say no.
In my last week's topic, I mentioned Aleister Crowley.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't really know much about him. I mean, it's just been this name. He's basically been an Aussie song, you know. And after digging into it, I am ashamed that I did not know about him. He's like this huge, influential cult figure.
Oh.
And the fact that, like, I didn't know about him. And not only that, his presence has been in my house my entire life, and I didn't even know that, which I'll reveal to you. That's what's hidden in this blanket next to me.
I thought you meant in, like, your bed. Oh. Sorry. My gut response was you.
So, I am ashamed. I should have known. I should have been very familiar with him. But now I am. It's never too late.
The first thing I looked for was I looked over to see if our cure candle was missing, to see if there was something about.
No, our cure candle's there. My pet rock is there. I have my sage because sometimes I have to smudge the house.
Will you smudge my house?
Later when it's ready to be cleaned.
Thank you.
Okay. So Aleister Crowley lived 1875 to 1947. So he was born in the Victorian era, the later Victorian era there. And he called himself the Great Beast 666.
Ooh.
The British press called him the wickedest man in the world.
That's quite a title for a name I've never heard out loud before you saying it.
Was he a genius? Was he a visionary? Was he depraved and evil? Let's dive in. Aleister Crowley was born into a wealthy family in Warwickshire, England.
I love it when you go into storybook mode. It's so soothing.
He was born there in the height of the Victorian era, so we know, you know, that's a very repressed time. His religious family warned him about the dangers of temptation and the consequences of sin. His parents were part of a religion called the Plymouth Brethren, and they were radical Protestants who are described as, in a documentary I watched, as pathologically anti-pleasure.
Oh.
So Aleister was taught to live life as sinlessly and joylessly as possible. Any indulgence was seen as the work of the devil. So Aleister didn't even play with other kids. He stayed inside and read the Bible. And so he was really bullied as a small child because he didn't like play with the other kids and play the reindeer games. Aleister was devoted to his father, and they traveled the country as his father evangelized. And Aleister was going to follow in his footsteps. But then 11-year-old little Aleister was devastated when his father died suddenly of tongue cancer, which I thought was a little bit ironic that he was preaching the word of God and
got
he died of
cancer.
Tongue cancer, yes. We don't need to read into it, but that just struck me as a little bit
I probably
like
don't need to laugh ironic. About it either, but I did already. Sorry.
Can't take your laughter back.
It's happened.
Aleister was so overcome with grief that doctors said he was in danger of dying. So his uncle took him...
From grief?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the Victorian time, so you could die of grief.
Okay.
His there was also that thing that people used to always get, consumption.
Like you died of consumption?
Like you could like be suffering from consumption. It was like this vague thing, like, what is that really?
Is that like drinking? Is that what it means?
I think it was like more than drinking. Maybe it's just an unhealthy lifestyle altogether.
Wait, what is more than drinking? Oh, like, yeah, is like that a way of saying like drinking and visiting the brothels, perhaps? Is that consumption?
Maybe.
Well, we'll look into that. Yeah, someone can let us know.
Future topic, consumption.
Maybe.
Alexa, did you hear that? I'm just kidding. I don't have Alexa.
I was gonna say, you don't own electronics.
Come on. I'm a conspiracy theorist. Do you think I would invite Alexa into my home? No way. Okay. So Alistair's uncle took him to his home in the countryside and allowed him to run around and have fun.
Crazy.
So this was novel. This was the first time in his life that little Aleister experienced a different way of living.
Apparently it's like TB.
Oh.
So we're like way off. Well, thanks, Sachi.
Thanks. That's why we have our team of experts there. So the uncle even took him to a pub and let him drink underage and paid for a sex worker so he could lose his virginity at the age of 15. Because remember, everybody thought he was going to die. So his uncle's like, let him live it up.
Yeah, the Wish Foundation?
Yeah, this is like an early version.
Yeah.
Where you get to go get drunk and laid.
Okay. I can see the allure.
But then he fully recovered. Darn it. And was sent back to live with his mother. But now it's a new Aleister. Little Aleister has changed. And
this is grown man Aleister.
Well, he's teenage Aleister.
Yeah.
And so
he's got a hair on his chest.
He had come to hate his overzealous mother, the church, everything that had prevented him enjoying his childhood. And he became increasingly rebellious and resentful, and he hated that everything that made people happy was considered to be a sin. So that's the basis of his life work right there, that thought. That everything that made people happy was considered to be a sin. So Alistair wrote lots of diaries and books and things. So there's all these records of his actual thinking. So this is from his diary. I wanted sin, spiritual sin, but hadn't the slightest idea of how to go about it.
Gosh, what a rebel. Could you imagine, like, all right, what on this list am I going to do anyways today?
So his mother declared that Alistair had become the beast from the Book of Revelation. Alistair said, so thanks, be it.
Thanks, Mom.
He despised his mother so much.
It's a hard title to shed.
He had sex on her bed with the maid.
Wow.
That's a big fuck you right there.
Yeah. At 15?
Yeah. And then after that, it ruined the maid's life because the mom publicly shamed her after she found out. And apparently, Aleister Crowley said later that she became Jack the Ripper's first victim and that he knew who the real Jack the Ripper was, because the maid had to go into a life of sex work after this, after she was publicly shamed.
Wow.
Isn't that an interesting connection?
Yeah.
Connections. So Alistair got sent away to attend Cambridge, so not too shabby. And in when he turned 21, he received his trust fund. Oh, his parents were rich, by the way. I forgot to mention that. So he received this trust fund, and then he decided to leave Cambridge to do whatever the hell he wanted, because he didn't have to work or anything.
Party.
So he hired sex workers. He ordered books on the occult. He published a book of poetry that was so pornographic that I'm not going to read anything out of it. And that means it's bad if I'm not going to read out of it.
I mean, we're explicit on here anyway, so
it just made me.
I'm just going to take
extremely uncomfortable.
I mean, we've had a whole episode on sex and orgasm, so I'm assuming that's pretty bad.
Yeah, and so this showed his growing obsession with sex, and then he published the book abroad under a false name so that he wouldn't be prosecuted for obscenity, which was a thing then. In Victorian.
We would be prosecuted.
England. So Alistair decided to set out to pursue his dream of becoming a black magician. He had heard there were secret societies that practice magical and rituals, and he wanted a big part of it. After a couple years of searching, he found the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Oh, okay.
Remember I talked about that last week, because the artist Pamela Coleman Smith, aka Pixie, she was a member of that, and she created that deck of tarot cards. So this order, they combined Egyptian and Kabbalistic practices and claimed they could do real magic as well as get to know their inner souls. And their membership included many upper class intellectuals and artists of the day.
Sounds like a retreat.
Bram Stoker was a member.
I don't know who that is.
Wrote Dracula.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And William Butler Yeats, poet, was a member. And the Golden Dawn had grades you advanced through, like Scientology. And in fact, Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard were also friends, another connection.
Hubbard.
And that Scientology may have been inspired by this order. Because remember, there's those different levels.
Yeah.
And then you get to like the alien level. And then really, you should walk away at that point if you haven't already.
Some like weird shit starts happening.
Really weird. That's when you like do like the things where you hold those metal cans and weird stuff. So Crowley just blazed through these grades like no one had before. Like, he just took to it. It was a natural. And now he's referring to himself as the Beast 666. He became very disappointed in the Golden Dawn. He thought they were playing at magic, and he tried to take the society over. But the other members really were teetotalers. And then here's Crowley, who took psychedelic drugs to enhance his spiritual experiences. And the other members became actually terrified of him. because he was interested in black magic.
Doing the drugs.
So Crowley's like, forget you all. You're just playing. I want the real world of magic. I want black magic. And so he left the Golden Dawn behind.
Leveled up.
So in 1899, Crowley decided to perform the Abra Melon ceremony. This is a black magic so powerful, no one had performed it for centuries. He was rich, so he bought a mansion on the shores of Loch Ness called Boleskine House, so he could perform this ritual. So this ritual takes 6 months to complete. It's very intense. You have to like do all these things like in the middle of the night. It's not a lot of fun. It's considered extremely dangerous because the end result is you actually are mastering demons, summoning demons. So
maybe that's why the mansion is necessary, so you can have all the hard nights and then go sleep in the nice bed.
Maybe, yeah. And hang out with Nessie on breaks. So if it goes wrong, evil spirits could be set loose and take possession of the magician.
Is Nessie an evil spirit conjured from the Victorian era?
I think Nessie might predate this, but I'm not positive.
I don't think so.
I'm not positive. I don't know. We
haven't had that topic yet.
We haven't added to the list. So Crowley went at this for a while, for a few months, and then he quit because it was taking too long to see results. There was no demons. He couldn't see anything, so he quit that. But now this mansion is said to be evil because Crowley did enough work there that he did end up unlocking the gates of hell. Years later, Jimmy Page, who I love, bought the house and did claim the house was truly haunted by Crowley's demons. You do know who Jimmy Page is, right?
No.
Oh my fucking God.
I'm bad with names in general.
Led Zeppelin?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You can say Led Zeppelin.
Have you heard of Led Zeppelin?
Yes.
Oh, thank God.
But I have not heard of his name.
His name. He's a guitarist.
Guitarist. Yes. Okay. Thank you. I wasn't a big Zeppy fan. It's a little out of my
He's such a good guitarist that people cannot like duplicate his work largely.
I know he's an amazing guitarist.
Yes. Okay, so Crowley.
Sorry, I offended you. So
I'm
much.
So offended right now.
Do you need more alcohol?
Yes. Crowley then met Rose Kelly, a society girl, and married her the next day after they met.
That's very full. Be careful.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I made a mistake.
Oh, I don't even know how to. See, normally if I wasn't strapped into this microphone, I would just lean over and like, you know. But
yeah, it's far away.
I think I'm going to be able to do it though.
Balance.
Look at
balance.
This.
Balance.
Look at this.
Oh, careful over the electronics.
I got it.
Sip it.
Did it.
I love that they got to hear the damage control. Good job.
Made it. I had to carry it right across my laptop. Did you see that?
Yeah, no, that was
stressy.
It was scary.
Okay, so he met Rose Kelly. He married her the day after they met. I'm thinking that's probably because they had sex. And he had to like prevent scandal there.
Yeah.
And then he immediately whisked her off to Egypt for a honeymoon.
Ooh, it's nice to have money to whisk people away.
And he described the honeymoon in his diaries. Quote, "The honeymoon was a period of uninterrupted debauchery. Once in the first 3 weeks or so, Rose took some trifling liberty. I recognized the symptoms and turned her up and spanked her. She henceforth added the qualities of a perfect wife to those of a perfect mistress."
Spankings? Okay.
Well, they didn't, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, this is times where women might have a wife who's very wholesome and pure, and, you know, it's all missionary and no sounds. Mm-hmm. And then you would go to a mistress or a sex worker and then get all your kinks out.
Spice it up.
Here's a picture of him when he was young. I find this picture fascinating. I don't think he was not a bad looking guy when he was young.
You and I don't have the same attraction type.
Like he's holding a wand.
We've established this that you really like that like child boy face. I don't know how to say that in a not offensive way.
Don't make me sound like a creeper.
I mean,
he is a man here. He's not a child boy.
He has a child boy face, though.
But he's, let's be clear, he's probably in his 20s, okay?
He's probably in his 20s, but he looks a solid 17.
Okay. So,
are you getting nervous?
Yes. Crowley spent the night with his wife in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, which I guess you could do at that time. That sounds super fucking cool and scary.
Yeah.
And he did this because he wanted his wife to witness what a great magician he was.
Ooh.
After dinner, they went there with candles. He spoke the preliminary invocation of the Goetia. And this is a practice that involves conjuring demons. The point of it is conjuring demons. So he's very interested in this black magic. He wants to conjure demons.
What, did he have like an end goal with this?
Conjure demons.
Yeah, no, but then what?
I don't know.
Because like, did, okay, now you got demons.
And maybe about harness the demon power.
With your, you know, wife there. Sounds like a good idea. Like, what does he think is going to happen? Befriend the demons? Or the demons eat his wife and suck out his brains?
Well, maybe that would just be a good night in Crowley's eyes.
Maybe.
A success, like
the
a
biggest
win.
F you to his parents possible is to be eaten by demons.
In the king's chamber.
In the king's chamber. Yeah. No.
Of the Great Pyramid.
Okay, it's making sense now. Okay. Thanks.
So this black magic ritual actually ended up being a huge turning point in his life. So after they left, Rose began acting really strangely and repeating in a weird voice, "They are waiting for you. They are waiting for you.
They are waiting for you."
And she told Crowley that Horus, an Egyptian god, was waiting for him. Crowley became super fucking irritated with his wife for acting like she was receiving a message from the gods when she knew nothing of magic or Egyptology. That was his jam.
It's that he sounds like he got a little jealous.
He was mad. He was jealous. He was mad.
And she was probably like, I just want to make him feel like he's doing something good.
He had been studying the dark arts for years and no demons had ever spoken to him.
At least he's honest.
So he decided to test her. Well, listen to this next part.
Okay.
He decided to test her. He took her immediately to an Egyptian museum and said, was like, okay, who's talking to you? And she ran through the museum and stopped immediately in front of a statue of Horus. And she'd never been to the museum before. And apparently knew nothing of Egyptology. And Rose said Horus wanted Crowley to go back to the hotel room where he would find out what it all meant. So on another point in the honeymoon, during a trip to the Egyptian Museum of Cairo, Crowley discovered the Steel of Revealing, which was inventory number 666.
Hmm.
It includes text from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And this artifact was very meaningful for Crowley, probably because it was 666. And he included it as a central element in his religion that he would later develop, called Thelema. So this was already a really big trip for Alistair. Mm-hmm. Lot happening in Egypt during the honeymoon. So much happening.
Other than romance.
Well, spanked Rose.
Mm-hmm.
On the 4th of April, 1904, in his hotel room in Cairo, Crowley finally found what he had been seeking. Crowley heard an unearthly voice from over his left shoulder. For 1 hour, at the exact same time, over the next 3 days, Crowley said the voice dictated to him the Book of the Law, which was the work that would become the Bible of his new religion. It's all about liberation, no restrictions.
Go figure.
You follow your goal in life above all else. So the Book of Law states its fundamental principle as this: do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Okay. Love is the law, love under will. There is no law beyond do what thou wilt.
Do you have like the anarchist cookbook or something under that blanket?
No.
Okay. Just checking.
So you may recall from last week that Crowley is a talented mountaineer.
I don't recall, but thank you for the reminder.
He'd been climbing since he was a teenager. And he set out to climb the world's third largest highest mountain. Oh, let's see if I can pronounce this. Kanchenjunga in Nepal.
I'm going to say no.
It's something like that.
Okay.
It starts with a K. And it's an elevation of 28,169 feet, so pretty tall. And he believed in the absolute supremacy of his will. So let's see how that turned out. Crowley was on this climbing expedition. Hold on, sake sip. With others in this climbing party. And he left the party because they didn't like how he kept bossing them around. So he's like, fine, I'll just leave and do my own thing. So the rest of the party was descending the mountain face when an avalanche struck. Crowley ignored the shouts of the men for help and stayed in his tent sipping tea.
Mm.
Four people were killed. Crowley, you know, knew what was happening. He just let them die. So the climbing world was just done with him after that. Because that's like breaking a serious code.
To not help the people. Not help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whatever. Crowley doesn't care. So he sets off across China with his wife, Rose, and their baby girl, Lilith. In Vietnam, Crowley left them to shack up with a mistress. And Rose couldn't cope on her own, and the baby ended up dying of typhoid. And Rose got blamed by Crowley for this death, and so he left her. And she's described as having gone mad after this. So that was an old days term.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much everyone who had a close relationship with Crowley had their lives ruined in one way or another. Okay, so back in England, things are starting to pick up. Crowley found his first actual disciple, a young Cambridge student and poet named Victor Newberg. Crowley was also a poet, so that he was drawn to him. And Newberg fell in love with Crowley and he was able to capitalize on that and lure him into black magic. So he took him out to the desert, 2 days walk into deep in the Sahara. They took hashish and mescaline and opened the gates of hell and summoned the devil.
Dang.
As they're having sex out there in the desert, Crowley has this epiphany that the act of sex can be in praise of the gods and summon the gods. And that through sex, you can shortcut this magical system and achieve your goals. So that if you're doing some kind of ritual at the moment of orgasm, like it gives you like this added power, like this shortcut, this like bridge to the magical world. Newberg never recovered from this experience. Crowley, however, came away with his major occult vision of sex magic with a K, magic with a K.
Ooh.
Sex magic. So this was like his thing he came away with. His occult vision. So let's see. So he wanted to start fulfilling his role as a prophet of his religion, Thelema. So he gets this farmhouse in Sicily or just takes it over. And this was going to be his temple. He set up the abbey in 1920 with his latest mistress, Leah Herzig. Their newborn baby, and some followers from around the world. So Crowley had met Leah when she was 19, and she was completely dedicated to him and prepared to do anything he asked. So from her diary in 1921, she says, "I will work for wickedness. I will kill my heart. I will be shameless before all men. I will freely prostitute my body to all creatures." So that's 100 years ago. That's like shocking now. Can you imagine 100 years ago how shocking it would have been?
Very shocking.
So shocking.
I'm so shocked.
So in Sicily, Crowley had his mistress, and then there was children and disciples. They all lived together on one roof, so sort of, you know, a communal thing. The point of living there was to discover your true will. They performed sex magic with a K rituals under the influence of hashish, opium, and cocaine.
Ooh.
They even had a dog named, guess,
Cocaine?
Satan.
Oh, dang. I could have done better.
I mean, now that's kind of like almost a cute name to name your dog, but back
Satan,
then
yeah.
it was probably a lot more serious.
Yeah, like here's our dog Satan. And everyone
Yes.
goes, oh,
And they're calling,
the
you know,
room
Satan, Satan.
aghast.
Yes. It was an experiment in a different kind of living there. So Crowley believed that if you gave people the freedom to do exactly what they wanted, it would lead to good.
You know, this is starting to sound more and more like a cult, like a cult, like commune cult.
Well, it's Thelema, his religion that he founded.
Thelema.
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 Yeah.
Like Thumbelina, but less letters.
Thelema. Thelema.
For some reason, you spelling it did not help me. It might
No.
have been all the sake I've had up to this
Sorry.
point.
This house is supposed to be cursed today, and locals are afraid of the place. So I watched a couple different YouTube videos of recent where people were going in there and checking it out. It's scary.
Isn't
It's fucking scary, yes. The walls are all painted. There's this room called the Nightmare Room.
it?
And it says on the walls, "Stab your demonic smile to my brain. Soak me in cognac and cocaine. Fuck Leah." That's from back in those times.
Wow.
So disciples had to take drugs, sit in there alone, and look at Crowley's pornographic demonic paintings on the wall. And this apparently would lead them to lose their fear and oppression. So
Is this like, say, satanic exposure therapy?
it's sex magic.
Sex magic.
So, as often happens, as we've seen in these situations, tolerance ensues and you have to level up, right? So
That's what you do. Your little dopamines in your brain stop getting excited.
the sex magic acts his followers were asked to perform became more extreme. And the event that I heard about that was the most shocking is when Crowley had Leah have sex with a goat, and at the time of orgasm, he slit the goat's throat.
Ew.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty extreme. I mean, that'd be extreme now. 100 years ago, that, you know, people would definitely think these were the devil, these people. But then things started to go wrong at the Abbey. I mean, you can't sustain that.
Yeah, there's only so many goats.
It's only so many things you can do with goats.
Gets
Leah
boring.
had a nervous breakdown, another old term. Crowley was struck, though I thought I was having one today at work. I'm like, I think this is what it feels like.
We now just politely call that burnout, which means you're done. You're done.
I felt like I just wanted to lay down in my bed with a cold compress, but I couldn't. Crowley was struggling with substance addiction at this point, but his work had to go on. So he's really trying to just up the ante here and gain control. People who used the word I had to cut themselves so that they didn't have their own identity. So if you accidentally said, "I'm hungry," you'd have to cut yourself.
That sucks.
Yeah. Crowley had to destroy people's egos to liberate them, was his, you know, reasoning with this.
Basically, they probably started giving some pushback and wanting things, and that didn't fly.
Yeah, you gotta gain control. You gotta put, you know, put your thumb on the peeps. Then one young follower died after allegedly drinking the blood of a cat sacrificed in a ritual. His wife left Sicily and went straight to the British press. Mussolini, of all people, eventually kicked out Crowley and his peeps.
Oh, wow. That's a statement.
Deserted by Crowley, another of the disciples killed themselves, and Leah had to turn to sex work to support herself. So the dream was over. The British press declared Crowley the wickedest man in the world. The last years of the great beast's life, he was in poverty, bankrupt, his fortune spent, no followers. He ended up in a boarding house in Hastings. Heroin addiction and infamy were all he had. But then in 1934, don't count Crowley out. He's not out. As an old, poor heroin addicted man, a young woman you know, he still had that magnetism, that rep, that infamy. A young woman approached him and said she wanted to have his child, his heir. And so they moved in together. She got him clean of the heroin so he could have the baby. He probably couldn't get it up, I'm imagining. They performed a sex magic ritual. Magic. And she gave birth to little Alistair. And this was probably the first person he ever truly loved. When Crowley wrote in his diary, weak erection, he knew that the end was near. It said when he passed, thunder boomed as the gods came to reclaim his soul. Because the devil had taken it. He was 77. Some people believe that Crowley became supernaturally evil and that demons worked through him and allowed him to dedicate his life to sex and magic. He still has followers today who see him as a true prophet, a genius, and are attracted to his philosophy of sexual and spiritual freedom. So he was a huge influence in like the Free Love 60s, as you can imagine. I mean, that thing he had in Sicily, even though it was kind of fucked up, is sort of like, you can see
anti-establishment,
the seeds of like a free love communal thing.
I don't know if free love is more like,
well, yeah, forced goat love,
but he probably left that out of the pamphlet. Right.
That's he the had small
really,
print.
He probably had really good brochures.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of, there's like 5 pages of small print. Okay, so give me some more sake, if you will. I can't reach it. So I, in my research, realized...
You said I. You must now slash yourself.
Slash. I realized that I've had Aleister Crowley in my house my entire life and just didn't know it. So here's my big reveal here.
Okay, what's under the blanket?
So, you know, I collect vinyl.
It always makes me nervous. You have, like, weird things in your house.
I do.
You do collect vinyl, yes. Yes.
Okay, so, and I love Led Zeppelin. As we've stated, Jimmy Page, I've always considered, like, my father figure.
Yes.
So, I didn't know this, but engraved on the album of Led Zeppelin 3 is Do What Thou Wilt.
What?
Uh-huh. Yep, it's right, if you can see
it. Can I see?
Yeah. It's right.
Can I touch it? Am I allowed to touch it? Is that why you're not letting me hold it?
It's so dark in here.
I can see better than you.
Okay, I think that's it right there.
Okay, let me see.
So.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
And that's my mom's Led Zeppelin album, so that has literally been in my house my entire life.
Is it in English?
Yeah, it's like cursive.
So it says so.
It says do. Do what thou wilt. Can you not see it?
All right, I see. So mote be it.
I think that you just can't read that.
There's an S and a O. So.
Maybe that's not it. I can't see anything in the dark.
M-O-T-E. And then be it.
That might not be it. Maybe look on the other side.
Okay, yeah, there are.
It's on there because I saw it in the daylight with my own eyeballs.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so there's that.
Mastercraft.
I couldn't find this album. I thought I owned it, but I didn't. So I had Paul bring over his. But look who's on the front of Sgt. Pepper's. It's Aleister Crowley right there.
Oh, weird.
I know. Isn't that weird?
Okay, okay.
It's up on the top, second from the left. If you're running right now to grab your Sgt. Pepper's album to see. So look at your Led Zeppelin 3. It's engraved like next to the label. Pull out your Sgt. Pepper's. He's right there. And then I've had this for a long time. Not my whole life, but I've had this Ozzy Osbourne, Mr. Crowley picture disc LP.
Oh.
And that's what I always, like, when I thought Mr. Crowley, just Ozzy's voice, Mr. Crowley, it would come in my head. But I didn't really, like, look into it or, like, understand who he was or, like, care, really. And then David Bowie's song, Quicksand, has lyrics that are all about Crowley and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And that's just one of many Bowie songs influenced by Aleister. In 2009, Jay-Z showed up on the internet wearing a Do What Thou Wilt hoodie. And that's when all the rumors of his involvement in, like, you know, the Illuminati and secret occult societies ensued. So I thought I would end with a little Alistair quote from his book Moonchild, because I kind of related to this. I mean, I can see the allure. May the new year bring you courage to break your resolutions early. My own plan is to swear off every kind of virtue so that I triumph even when I fail.
Wow, that's deep. It's like the power in failure.
Yeah, I can totally relate. It's like ownership. Like, I create my own narrative. I flip. Okay, we need to clarify. They're tiny bottles.
They are little bottles.
It's not like, I mean, you make it sound like I'm going these to get are, another fifth.
No, these are
little sake bottles.
Little self serve. Like, this would be for one person, and we've been sharing.
I'll be back.
Okay, I'm so excited for my topic.
Crowley.
I don't even know that song. Is that a common one?
Yes, it's a common one. Well, I love Black Sabbath, so.
Okay.
Maybe it's only common if you love Black Sabbath.
Okay. My topic, I'm just going to do the little teaser of it, kind of relates to roller derby.
Oh, kind of.
Kind of, I know. Okay, I'm going to play a clip first. And we'll see if you can hear this audio or not. But you'll be able to see the video, but everyone else will see the.
Oh, my God.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. Wait, I don't hear sound.
I see Hulk Hogan. Oh my God, that's so loud.
Ow.
Sorry, people.
Ow.
Are you talking about wrestling?
Yes.
Oh my God, I have a story. Right on.
So, this is a Hulk Hogan video. So I'm going to talk about the world of professional wrestling.
Are we doing WWE? Are we doing WWF?
We're going to talk actually about kind of the broader U.S. Kind of umbrella with some of those. So let's see here. Okay, so first of all, the reason why I'm relating this to roller derby is because back in the, 70s for roller derby, it was... Was it 70s?
I think it might have been farther back. I'm not sure. I think roller 60s? Derby was like the 50s, maybe.
Maybe.
You know, it was invented by a Jew.
Mm. Mm. You want to talk about like ghost stuff? Remember that haunted house I lived in? In the attic drawer, there was like old newspaper from the 50s. Like, I think it was like 59. Lining the drawers. And I pulled one out and there was an advertisement for roller derby. Talk about weirdness, right?
That is so weird.
Yeah. It was like one of the Bay City bomber things.
San Francisco.
Bay City something. Yeah. Okay. So anyways, the connection here between roller derby and this is that there was a period in time when it was more staged and planned out.
Yes.
In some aspects. So first I want to just say like, same thing with roller derby back in the day, but more so with wrestling. It was really a guarded sport. So many fans did not know that it was scripted. And many fans really like would believe the storylines that were happening.
That's still true.
I mean, I think there's probably like a chunk of people, but I think it's more common knowledge now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is.
Okay.
Is it not?
I'm not going to say what I was going to say. It's too judgy and mean.
It's more publicized now, we'll just say that, than it used to be. Like, it used to be, like, hushed
again,
by
I
the
have
industry.
Really judgy, mean thoughts that I'm just not going to say.
Why?
Because it's not nice.
Okay, well, then
and
you know,
being,
be nice.
Being mean is just so easy. So, but holding back is hard. And
you
I'm going to take the higher road.
You doing this is still being mean, just so you know. You don't get a pass for that. Okay, so... really with the internet, I think it becomes more obvious that there's more going on versus when the internet wasn't there. As far as like learning, do you remember how I poured it for you and made it easy? You making me work for this is not appealing. Okay.
I wasn't paying attention to your method. I'm sorry.
Okay. There have been a lot of ways that they have really kind of hidden the behind the scenes of what goes on in professional wrestling. So that's really going to be my focus point, is like the behind the scenes of professional wrestling. I'm excited
about this.
So this does include the whole WWE universe, that whole, it's kind of like
WWF.
Yeah. So we know more now because more people have been able to talk about what it was like in those roles, who have now since retired or have left that industry. So it's really hard to keep secrets in the current wrestling era, which is why the WWE universe is the most clued in that we've ever really been. But still, there's a lot that is still kind of kept under the surface. So I think at most someone might know that, like, maybe not like it's scripted, but that it's maybe planned out in advance. Like, I don't know. Do you think people know that they have a clear winner picked out before that even starts? Or am I like ruining someone's life right now? I didn't even think about this. Am I shattering?
Are
things?
The Jewish kid telling Christian kids there's no Santa right now?
Damn it. Okay. I didn't even think about that. Okay. Well, let's just start with the fact that WWE had really started bringing in a number of faces from independent scenes for wrestling, and so they really started bringing them into like the modern eye. But they actually, there was a sad reality that they actually started signing people from other companies to stop competition. So it would look like they got this like big person signed over to them from this other place, and it's really exciting, but it was one way to rule out competition as a like kind of a network thing.
So it could get control.
Yeah, so to reduce competition. So that's kind of like one shady thing that happens in the background. Did you ever hear of Brock Lesnar, if you're a WWE person?
I'm not a WWE person.
Okay, some people might be. They actually pushed him at the top of their promotion over the past few years. They were like really trying to get him to get a win over The Undertaker.
The Undertaker. I've heard of The Undertaker.
Undertaker, but back at WrestleMania.
To be honest, I thought that was a monster truck.
That was in 2014. Really? We're probably not the best ones to do this topic, but so before he went to become the long reigning WWE World Heavyweight Champion, he had the longest reigning and defending his championship out of anybody. But despite being the top, Brock had been splitting his time between both WWE and the UFC.
Is that bad?
Well, so he failed a drug test. That was something that happened. And he was later suspended from UFC because of it. It's unknown where that left his victory, because they were assuming that he was having to use drugs in order to cheat to win certain matches. Okay, so this one's going to really hit home for you. So this is wrestling politics. Derby had politics too.
Do you mean drama?
Drama. I mean, like the behind the scenes.
Because politics makes it almost sound legitimate.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it look like it's like based on someone's talent, the raw talent. I can't.
Are you trying to do a wrestling voice?
I was trying to do the Hulk Hogan. I can't do it.
I'll see you in the ring.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Rah. Actually, here I have a
I only know the names of wrestlers that were like popular in the 80s.
Tell my Hulkamaniacs, say your prayers, take your vitamins, and you'll never go wrong.
That's right. I mean, they did some good shit talking.
They did. They
pretty really entertaining.
Did. Yeah. And that's really what it was focused on, at least largely for the public. But politics was a huge thing backstage in WWE. It seemed that if there was a superstar who ended up on the wrong side of a WWE legend, it could have a huge effect on the star's career. So Baron Corbin is an example of that. When he came to light that Baron had a backstage argument with John Cena. You know, you've heard jokes about Cena, right?
No.
Okay.
Enlighten me, Macy.
Wrestler jokes. I don't know. Look up a meme.
I don't know.
It's memes.
Wrestler jokes.
as well as a Twitter spat he had with Dave Meltzer, which then saw him unsuccessfully cash in his money in the bank briefcase. WWE then decided to scrap his entire planned push because of these two altercations. So, like, fighting backstage ended up impacting his career forward within the ring.
Sounds like he was really popular. He weighed 251 pounds? Damn.
Did he?
Yeah, and
Oh, yeah, that's him. That's Cena,
pectorials.
Right?
Pectorials.
Yeah, John Cena. Got the pecs. Also, WWE really... So the reason, actually, that this topic came into my mind was I watched on Netflix Glow. If you haven't seen
I love Glow.
Yeah. So that's what made me think of this
connection
topic.
Connection to Rumpology.
Oh.
Because remember?
No.
She, Mama Stallone.
Oh, was she a female wrestler?
Well, she ran a female wrestling thing that Glow is modeled after. Remember, she had the rap where she promoted Glow Girls.
That's right.
Or whatever. I think they were called something like that, Glow Girls.
Yeah. The glamorous ladies of wrestling.
Mama Stallone fucking rapped. Look at these connections, left and right.
Right. So, okay. But WWE really is not a safe working environment for women. Shocker there. I mean, I think that's kind of a big no-brainer. But there was once a time when WWE's women division was all about looks. That was really like the initial part of it.
So you had to be pretty.
In the history. Yeah. That was one of the downfalls during that era. It led to many superstars thinking that these women were just objects. So if you think about, you have a bunch of souped up men who feel very high and mighty about themselves, knowing that women wrestlers are being hired for their looks, it sets up a bad situation.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So Sable was one of the first women who walked away from the company and decided to sue them for harassment. She had gotten as part of the show. There was also the first ever female WWE referee, Rita Chatterton, who was part of the company in the 1980s. And she ended up leaving and accused Vince McMahon of assault. Ashley Massaro also recently claimed that she was assaulted while on a tour with WWE, and the company told her to keep it quiet.
Not good.
Because their whole thing is you're supposed to be a strong woman that's pretty. So reporting claims of assault means that what?
How are you not a strong woman if you're doing that? I think that's really strong. It's brave.
Yeah.
Because you know people are going to give you a bunch of shit.
But that totally goes against their image of what a woman is and does.
So they don't mean strong. They mean what? Submissive? Quiet?
They mean do your job and shut up. That's what I think they mean. So WD also often edits their crowd's reactions. So that's really kind of the big thing, is like the reaction from the crowd to different things. So they decide which superstars are pushed and which ones the companies decide to release. So most of the time, WD already knows which stars they want to push to the top of the brand. And so if they don't get the reaction that they want, the company decides to edit it out. So they will... Everything's very strategic with who fights who. They're gauging audience reaction. So they tend to know in a certain matchup what's going to happen. And if it doesn't, they will edit the audience out and potentially replace it.
One of my favorite movies is Nacho Libre.
I want to like that movie, and every time I watch it, I get really bored.
Every time I watch it, laugh more than I did the first time I watched it.
It's so boring. It's so boring.
There's so much subtle humor, and it just gets better every time you watch it.
It's like boring. Like, I literally have fallen asleep.
I'm gonna watch
twice.
It after you leave.
I hate this movie. I hate it because everybody mentions it, and I cannot
fucking hilarious
stay awake. It's not funny enough for me to
stay
awake.
It's so funny. But I think you have to like Jack Black.
I like Jack Black.
I mean, come on, with the fucking toast under the door?
I don't even know.
It's all crunchy. Like, that is comic gold right there.
Mm.
And how they both like light tan is their favorite color. I mean, come on. Can't make that shit up.
I mean, that's all.
I mean, they
like,
did make that shit up.
Yeah.
And that's genius.
But it's stupid. That's stupid. That's stupid. And
sweats.
It's all just so stupid. I don't know. I think they could have done better. Or just not made it at all.
And poopies. Poopies and light tan and toast. I mean, come on.
Okay. Just doesn't do it for me. I don't know.
All right, it's fine. We can agree to disagree. Look at us making an example for the world.
Yes. I still agree.
You can be friends with people that don't love Nacho Libre.
Naomi and I have a lot of differences. Ooh, this one tastes way different than the other one. Mm, it's making me have a face. What is that?
It's just not as sweet as the other one.
Okay. All right.
Kumpai, just shoot it.
This also relates to roller derby. I have something to tell you that I totally forgot. Off mic, afterwards. Remind me.
Okay.
Okay. The referee is an integral part of the show.
Oh, is it about referees?
It's about a referee, yes.
Okay.
Who decided to reach out to me after years again.
Oh.
Yeah, I'll let you know. It's not...
It's not who I think?
No.
Oh.
In any...
Oh, I know who it is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Thank you. In any sport, the referee is the person who's been chosen to represent all of the rules and uphold them. This is slightly different in wrestling.
Are there referees, like roller derby referees?
So it's a little bit different. So most of the time, referees are actually part of the show. So the referee has a speaker in his ear where he can talk to the producers backstage watching the match. So they're watching the match, engaging crowd reactions, and the referee actually relays messages to performers in the ring. So if there's something that needs to be happened or like needs to happen, or like how long is left in the match or where a certain spot, like they need to be in the next thing, like they'll give them information.
They're part of the production crew.
Yeah. So the referee actually has a lot of power in the ring, and the WWE stars have to listen to him because he's the only communication between them and the people running the show when they're in the ring. So not everything is actually a storyline though. Which I think that's where like people who think, oh, it's all scripted, but like to a point. They do plan the shows in advance, but what that looks like is really different. So it'll be things like they know we want you to do XYZ moves at some point, and we need this ending. And then you get a lot of improvising.
So it's not completely choreographed.
No. So, okay. And I think that's where
I always thought it was completely choreographed.
Because, like, in GLOW, the show, like, it really had them, like, they're intensely practicing the moves with that partner, so they would have it down like that, which they might have. But it, for more of these experienced people, it's more of, like, you know, we're going to briefly go over the gist of what we're going to do. But it's not necessarily so scripted that everything they do is planned. There is
there's some room for ad-libbing.
Yes, there is ad-libbing, absolutely. So they plan their shows actually up to a year in advance, and then sometimes small things change if there's injuries or problems. Despite all the planning, people do things that they're not supposed to. First of all, there'll be a promo where it might become quite personable or personal unintentionally. So sometimes somebody actually gets pissed off in a promo video against the other person where they're doing the shit talking to each other.
Because it like pushes some buttons or something.
Yeah. Or other side, someone could just forget their lines, like what they were supposed to say that actually like would trigger this other part of a thing that's supposed to happen. Because being that planned out, I mean, it may impact. Or there may even be a match where the wrong person wins by accident because someone failed to like kick out at two, like at the, you know, one, two, and they forget to do it.
Tap out.
Yeah. They called it a kick out. I don't know.
Well, maybe that's what it is. I don't know.
This isn't my world. So like that can happen.
I know tap out's like a brand,
and it's actually apparently like pretty common that does happen, because if you think about it, they also may tell them like, okay, you have this much time left, but they're not in the midst of like WrestleMania. You may lose track of time and not know when it's actually ending, so you may be like thinking you're at a different spot. Yeah, So you might miss it.
Well, I could see me like being like, fuck, I don't want to lose this one, even though I'm supposed to. I'm gonna
win.
I'm gonna just, yeah, throw this person over the ropes.
They pay you to do what you're told, to shut up and do what you're told.
Yeah, I wouldn't last long in this world.
No, you would not. So there's kind of two parts. Not all injuries are real. That's something to keep in mind.
Is there fake blood?
Or is the blood real? There at certain points, they have used things to make injuries look real. The use of social media and wrestling over the past few years has increased quite a lot. And so they've really been using that to kind of manipulate their audience into thinking that something's real. Mm. So some WWE stars have been forced to relinquish championships due to injury and spend lengthy spells on the sidelines. And it seems that WWE has now reached a point where they know how to fake an injury to help build a good storyline. So they'll have a really good injury where they can build up storyline and like a comeback. Create
sympathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So Seth Rollins had an injury before WrestleMania. And that was an example of how they used something that was fresh in the minds of WWE Universe to build into a non-sanctioned match, even though Rollins was never actually injured to begin with. So they like said he was in an unsanctioned thing and then used that as part of story.
In your research, did you discover the reason behind the obsession with metal folding chairs?
It is actually mentioned here in a bit. It's not really an obsession. I think it's like what's an easy object to grab that's fairly affordable.
I've never watched like a full one of these wrestling matches, yeah. But what I have watched,
there's
heavily featured metal folding chairs.
They're the real star.
People falling on them, people being hit by them, like tangled up, a lot of metal folding chair action.
So wrestlers have been known to talk while they're in the ring. Most of the time it's covered by trash talking, so fans really don't hear it. Because they keep the trash talking really loud, and then they'll have like smaller conversations. Where they're like,
hey, step 3 feet over there. Okay, cool.
But the real reason for this is that there are a number of wrestlers who like to call the match in the ring. So when wrestlers reach the point where they know each other's move sets really well, they will no longer have to plan the match. So instead, they go out to the ring and talk to each other through the matches as it happens. So some people don't plan it at all ahead. They just know each other's moves well enough that they kind of talk themselves through it together.
Okay.
It's actually pretty standard to do, pretty regular basis.
Kind of like at the beginning of the season, they'll be like, okay, this person is going to eventually rise to the top. And here's all our different storyline paths. Is that
roller derby hive mind? Like you get to know your partner so well.
That is hive mind. Yeah, we can read each other and anticipate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wrestlers are trained like actors, though. So they're, you know, they're big, flashy clothes, their storylines. They're like way bigger than real life. And that's very intentional. They actually go through promo classes where they learn how to talk to an audience and how to react when the audience is booing them.
Oh, what are they supposed to do? Get mad?
Stay in character is probably the
But it's supposed to be like,
it probably depends.
I hate all you.
Because there's like, if you watch Glow, there's like the bad characters.
Right.
Where they'd probably be like, what? Yeah. Obscenities. And then there's probably the good character that doesn't get booed. It's
kind of hurt.
Yeah. Maybe they get booed at the, like, because they're losing. And then they're like, America.
Okay. Take a knee. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
an eagle cries or something.
Yeah. Got it. And they're like, let me put on my halo.
Yeah, like
pray.
Why?
Yeah.
I'm gonna get you.
I love that.
Next time.
I mean, I get the world of the Glow. Like,
yeah.
That seems more accessible to me than like the WWE or F times.
Well, Actors are also given classes when it comes to their character. So that's like how to, like, their specific character, and taught how to adapt it in certain situations. It's a lengthy process before any stars even make it to TV, which is where there's even more hard work, where they're trained on social media, like how to respond on social media so they can know what they can and can't post online.
Wait a minute. Do they have to be in character all the time?
All the time.
That's exhausting.
It's exhausting. Yes. So Vince McMahon apparently is a big name. I wasn't aware of him, but he's the chairman of WWE. But apparently he actually isn't the only person who has power. There is a team of executives who make things and plan things. I don't know. People who may know him may understand why that matters. I don't, but... wrestlers do give their own ideas, like, for what they would like to do, or the, like, pitches, basically. They get their own creative team, and they try to pitch characters or, like, combinations and fights, and they either get accepted or declined.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I'm gonna stand up on these ropes and fling myself back like a rubber band. That would be my move.
Yeah.
I'd want to do that.
And like for wanting to work with certain people. So for example, James Ellsworth revealed that it was Carmella's idea for him to work with her to help her to become the first ever Miss Money in the Bank. Ooh. The former NXT star went to Vince McMahon and pitched her idea for herself before Vince, and it was approved so they could do some duo work together to help boost her character.
So if we would have just used our same roller derby names in wrestling, like, you would have been a bad character and I probably would have been a good character, because my name has the word sweet in it.
Well, yeah, and I'm womb punch.
Womb punch.
Yeah, I probably would have been a bad guy. So speaking of, many wrestlers aren't friends backstage. This also reminded me of roller derby. They often make the decision to pair together some superstars because their characters complement each other, but doesn't mean they get along in real life or even close to being
friends.
That's
like when I'd put a line together because it was an awesome line and they all hated each other.
Yeah, it's like too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I won't say anything. too soon.
Is it though? It's been a long time. We've gone through COVID.
Give me another few years and then I'll speak out publicly.
A few years? That's a long time. I'll speak out publicly.
Spokane small.
Yeah, it's okay. Don't be bitchy and people will like you more. That's all. Okay. There have been a number of teams over the past few years that work together on screen but hate each other backstage. Alexa Bliss and Sasha Banks are a good example. Despite not liking each other, the two women were able to put together a decent rivalry over the Raw Women's Championship.
Okay, I will say something about roller derby.
Okay.
I had a pretty big arch
Speak
enemy
your truth.
At one time. A long time. In my
Before I knew
yes,
in derby?
In my first team. And I actually played really well with my arch enemy because I was so terrified of being on their opposite team or even separated from them in the pack that my best safety was to be like hip and hip.
Yeah.
It was survival.
I mean, and to me, it's never about anything off the track. It's what is our role on the track? And you,
this was the person that would try to trip me in drills. Talk about
I have
stupid
to say,
drama.
I've only seen one drama play out on the track, like, actually, and that was when we had that, I don't want to say names, but what's it called? When you have people and you train them. See how long it's been?
Fresh meat?
No, bigger. Oh. Workshop of some kind? I don't know.
A training?
Whatever. We invited people to come and work on things.
Yeah.
Okay. And one skater got pulled back by her ponytail and completely knocked on her back by another skater just randomly in a drill.
I don't remember that.
Well, they knew each other outside of derby. and there was like feelings there, and something outside came inside, and there was
a, you got to leave it off the track.
A ponytail,
you
got to
leave it on the track. It,
ponytail to the ground. That was fun. That was the first time I got to mediate a breakup of a fight. back off. Okay. Money plays a big role in this. Surprise, surprise. Brock Lesnar is a part-time superstar, and he earns more money than any of the WWE's full-time roster. So really, the more money you have, odds are you're probably going to play more and then get paid more in return.
That makes sense.
They use a lot of camera angles to their advantage. So they try to get certain angles where it won't show empty seats in the crowd, where it always looks like a full house, basically.
It's all about the angles.
Yeah. So that's like, especially when they're doing like pay-per-view for like world broadcast, every single one will look completely packed. And what they'll do is they'll even set the seating. I've seen it in hockey games too, where they'll like just leave a whole section empty instead of having people
sporadic.
And then just
don't film that section.
Yeah. And then you just cut out that side and you don't film that angle, and you plan for it ahead based on pre-sale tickets. Yeah. So you may do closer down versus doing wider pans.
Oh, I see that shit on the news all the time. They want to make it look like there's more people. They do a closer shot.
Yeah, exactly.
like if there's actually not a lot of people, they'll just keep it real close.
Yeah. Commentators aren't allowed to say certain things. So they're given scripts. The words include calling superstars wrestlers or women divas. Yeah, so they're not allowed to call them divas or... Let's see here. Calling superstars wrestlers or women divas.
You're not allowed to do that?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Or even mentioning anything outside of a promotion specifically. If they say something they weren't supposed to, Corey Graves apparently revealed that Enzo Amore cheated on Liv Morgan while he was on a commentary, which didn't go very well with executives and had an impact on him being in the next airing. So, from what I've heard is that it is very expensive as well to get into the world of wrestling, and very highly demanding. Like, they expect a lot of, so if you think amateur, like this is professional, but amateur, like to get going, it's a lot of money that they expect up front, and a lot of
physical
demand.
You got to pay to play?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, you got to be very fit.
Sometimes. Amateur, not as often, but, or like it's, you see more variety.
Do they have to pay for their own outfits?
It's a lot of like paying for travel, paying to use facilities. Like, they get the money out of them, basically, in variety of ways. Yeah. Okay. So WWD often does things to spite the WWE universe. So because of storylines, they're like, storylines just keep growing and getting more and more complex. So most of the time they're open to giving the WWE universe what they want. This has happened many, many times. But the company then used like different things, to like counter the storyline almost as like a slight F you on occasion of like not following
little
something.
Little acts of rebellion.
Yeah, little teeny acts. Yeah. So WWE hold people back if they don't meet their standards. So they have an image to uphold. So if somebody's not meeting that, then they will tell them that this a B+ player.
Is that bad?
Yeah. I mean, it just means you're not
an A
player.
I mean, to me, that depends on the class.
Do you remember that we never wanted a B team?
Never. We wanted an A team only.
Well, and it made people feel like if you're part of the B team, there's no way that's not going to feel bad.
Yeah. We're one team only. One team strong. One mission to rule the world.
Yeah. So.
Or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So there are a few select guys who can go off script. So people like Paul Heyman, John Cena, and The Rock.
Oh, Dwayne.
Dwayne, yep.
Dwayne Johnson.
They're the only stars who are reportedly allowed to, quote, do whatever they want in the WWE ring.
Because they're untouchable?
Yeah.
They're just too popular?
Yeah. The Rock proved this when he called former WWE champion CM Punk a few months ago while he was in the middle of the ring. And they just like...
Wait, a few months ago? He still does this? I thought he was just acting.
This might be an old article. So he called CM a punk, and they turned him off, like, off the air, like, shortly after that.
I think Rock's just doing the Jumanjis these days.
Yeah.
So hanging with Kevin Hart.
Probably. They'll do anything to avoid bad publicity. They do a lot of promotion worldwide. I mean, Hulk Hogan always comes to my mind of, like, that wrestle persona.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him from the 80s. I remember Rowdy Piper because the kilt, which I think he actually passed away. But, like, those are the only names. But I never really watched it. But that just shows how big in the culture it was that even though I didn't watch it, like, I still knew these names. And I still knew what this world was.
Was that, like, bigger when you were, like, in high school age?
80s?
Yeah.
I think WWF was really big then. WWE wasn't that big, but it was, like, a thing. And if we have time, I have a personal story.
Yeah, here in just a sec. So, last thing I was going to add is that even though a lot of it's scripted, there are many, many injuries that happen, because it is still very physical. You are still getting men dropped on you. And yes, they train to, like, reduce the damage. But the way that everything I've read is that, like, it's going to hurt, but it's part of the job. So you just try to reduce the amount of hurt.
Well, how can it not hurt if you're getting smacked on the back of the head with a metal folding chair? That yeah. has to hurt unless the chairs are props.
Well, and the thing,
fake.
They're not fake. And that's the thing is, yeah, like, I mean, even just, like, doing a, like, where somebody, like, fake hits you, I mean, you're still getting an impact, mm-hmm. and you're landing on your back. Like, there are things that your body, I mean, all of that is still physical and can have risk for injury.
And there's probably mishaps and mix-ups, like, the person's supposed to fall on you in a certain way where they don't, like, damage your internal organs, but maybe they mess up and you get a knee to the soft parts.
Yeah. Yeah. So concussions are a big part of that. There was actually a big lawsuit from former WWE people who had reported a long list of concussions in the business too. So I was just going to go over some of the worst kind of reported injuries that have come up. 2001, Sid Vicious had a broken leg. This was a pay-per-view
from the
event.
Sex Pistols?
Not the real Sid Vicious.
Oh.
Character Sid Vicious. So he took a dive from the second turnbuckle to deliver a big boot on his opponent. So again, a planned move. But when Vicious launched the move, things immediately took a turn for the worse. So he made his landing in a weird way. He broke his leg in the ring. Ugh. And the natural... I mean, that's just graphic in general for an on-air footage. So you can actually even, like, look that up and see it happen.
No, thank you.
He spent the next 3 years.
I've been
years.
Traumatized by enough videos that I've watched.
I know. 3 years rehabilitating.
I mean,
his leg.
I saw it live when that football player broke his tibia and fibia, and they played it, like, 100 times on repeat. Like, stop. I can't watch it anymore.
Okay, so this one, like, gives me shivers. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Oh, I've heard that name.
Yeah. He got a broken neck. Yeah. Owen Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin clashed at the Intercontinental Championship in 1997 for SummerSlam. At one point in the match, Hart bolted a pile driver and left Austin with a broken neck. So a pile driver is this position here. So he's holding him upside down.
And what's supposed to happen with his neck? When you go down, like, is he supposed to tuck and roll? Is it supposed to, like, be a gentle thing?
So it's supposed to be where he would go down and kind of roll out of it. but he didn't. He hit his neck very, very hard. And was actually broke his neck. It caused temporary paralysis.
Oh, that's fucking terrifying. Mm-hmm.
And he had many neck problems from then on out.
I thought the pile driver was something different. I've always imagined it as different.
Here's what I thought the pile driver was.
I thought it was where, imagine like somebody's on my bed, like my victim, where where you like leap up in the air and you pile drive them with your elbow in their body.
Oh no, this is you pick them up with their head facing the ground and you like have them by their waist and then you.
No, that seems worse.
Oh, yeah, no,
than what
worse.
I was thinking.
Yeah.
Then like they're the pile driver. I was thinking
not
the
you.
Attacker was the pile driver.
No, it's their head in the ground.
It seems like a fucked up idea.
Right? Like somebody's going to get hurt. And they did.
And they did.
Joey Mercury had a broken nose. So this involved a ladder. So it was a ladder match at 2006 Armageddon pay-per-view again. So again, it's live. He had a ladder to the head at the end.
And was it supposed to like miss him? Like he was supposed to go between the rungs?
I mean,
and then it
I think it hit
him on the nog.
I think it's supposed to hit him, but just maybe not break his nose. And I think that's the where's that line of like enough to make it look like impact, which means you have to have some contact and too much.
Well, and here's the thing. They're adrenalized.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard.
Drugs is a big thing in this. Steroids is also a thing.
Oh, so you're on drugs. You're adrenalized.
Potentially.
And it's really difficult, I think, to stay on track with the script and have that self-control that you need, those fine motor skills, you know, or gross motor skills, actually, that you need to like land that ladder just right if you're out of your mind and body.
Yep. Yep. So, I mean, he was actually like gushing blood 30 stitches after. Ooh. Yeah. He had to wear a face mask after that when he went back into the ring to protect his nose after that.
Oh, I'd be so scared of him in the nose again.
Triple H had a torn quad against Stone Cold Steve Austin in that one. Took him out of the sidelines for quite a while. He did end up winning a 2002 Royal Rumble, though, a little while later. So I like this one, which is for Mick Foley, that says pretty much everything is the description.
Of injuries?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the 1998 Hell in a Cell match between The Undertaker and Mick Foley, it's the most famous wrestling match in history. Because those reasons, there were many severe bodily injury harms done, and it was mainly invoked at the expense of Foley. This was the list. He had multiple puncture wounds.
What?
A hole in his lip, a dislocated shoulder, a concussion, and a dislocated jaw. And if that wasn't enough...
How did that happen?
When the wrestler smiled at the camera at the end of the match, fans noticed one of his teeth was coming out of his nose. Out of his nose.
Oh.
It came out of his nose.
That's adrenaline right there.
Yeah. It's crazy. So that got out of hand, I would say.
I got out of hand.
Did you I got a hand?
No, that got out of hand. In the chat, Paul mentioned Lyle Alzado, who got a concussion. Mm. Did that come up in your research at all?
Probably. There's a lot. Yeah, these are just like what they label like the worst. Concussions were pretty standard fare for a lot of wrestlers. It just wasn't talked about because like obviously
really
the WWE wasn't going to highlight it.
I mean, even now, still...
Yeah, we've talked about it as a topic.
It's
concussions.
Yes. I think there's a lot of money involved in these big sports, mm-hmm. and it's difficult. I haven't seen that Will Smith movie, Concussion, but I think that's about that topic.
Hardcore Holly also had a broken neck.
Hardcore Holly. I love that name. That's a mm-hmm. derby name right there.
That is
there.
A derby name. He's one of the few fighters who actually competed and became a champion in mixed martial arts. He faced Lesnar and things didn't go so well. He was, so Lesnar power bombed his, so power bombed, whatever that is really bad, into the mat, but unfortunately he botched the power bomb altogether, resulting in Holly being at the receiving end of a broken neck. He's fortunate he didn't end up paralyzed, but very likely could have. Droz was actually paralyzed from the waist down. This was in 1999. This was during a SmackDown match that was to be aired to the public. He's now in a wheelchair because of this. He fractured two discs in his back, becoming quadriplegic. Since the injury, this wrestler has regained some use of his upper body, including his arms, but still paralyzed from the waist down.
God, that sucks.
I do want to mention just really quickly, Owen Hart, who did die. He was competing under the name of Blue Blazer in 1999. Owen Hart was set to face the Godfather in a match for a championship. For his interest, he did his best to emulate Sting. He would descend into the ring. He's carrying a Canadian flag.
Sting, the police?
No, Sting the singer?
Yeah, from the police.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't from Canada. What does that
mean? I don't know. There's a Canadian flag. This. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
I just felt sucky all over myself. He descended into the ring from the arena rafters. But unforgettably for Hart, things didn't go as planned with that. He was hooked up in a harness, but something went wrong with his cord, and the wrestler crashed into the ring from really high up, and his injury sustained to be fatal. He was 34 years old.
Fuck.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of other broken back injuries, torn ligaments. So I don't want people to come away from this thinking like, oh, it's all fake. It's all scripted. Like, these are still, I would say, athletes and human beings doing very athletic things
in skin sacks,
within the realm of like trying to please a crowd,
entertainment,
which is so hard, mixing athleticism and entertainment, because your odds are you're going to push yourself to do something you shouldn't.
And that sometimes came up in roller derby.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, should we play easier because it's not fun for the crowd to see a blowout? And my opinion was always like, fuck no.
You got to play your hardest.
Yes, always play your hardest.
It doesn't mean that the big rule was don't be a dick.
Don't be an asshole. Yes, but you can still find ways to play your hardest. Like maybe, you know, because we would always practice like these trick plays at practice and we hardly ever do them in a game. Maybe it's time to try them in a game.
Maybe it's time to have Womb Punch do a few jams, because why not?
Yeah.
See her get winded.
Because it's so insulting if you're the losing team to know the other team is fucking sandbagging.
We've had that before.
It's so insulting. Mm-hmm. And I always was like, no, we got to go hard all the time. 100%. And I always thought the hardest times to play your best are when you're losing and when you're winning. And that was always something I challenged our team to do, is play your best in those situations. Like, it's easy to play your best when it's neck and neck.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I kind of view it like playing tennis. So if you have someone that's playing tennis really well, and then you have someone who's like lobbing and the balls are like, it's so much harder to play a good game when you're so mismatched like that. So you either have to like play your best game with whatever comes over the net. Because if you try to just play at what they're doing, it doesn't work.
No.
The ball's going to fly out.
You got to play your game.
Yeah.
My sock is soaked with sake. I have a sake sock.
Podcast name. All right.
Write it in your journal.
Okay.
Do you want to hear my personal story?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay. This is me being honest about my life. So what is that on your journal? Is that Blinky?
It's from Pac-Man.
I know, that's Blinky. Yes.
Uh-huh.
No, I know.
Holder. Okay.
I know Pac-Man very well.
Are you upset with me?
No, I'm
okay.
I'm
You're very aggressive sounding.
I don't know what this emotion is. I'll identify it later. I'm okay. Something.
Sake is an emotion.
Sake is an emotion. When I was a teenager, I was a very, very bad girl, let's just say. Very bad.
If you don't believe us, go check out our Facebook group, Deeply Disturbing Things. She has a picture of her Flock of Seagulls haircut.
No, I was very bad. And actually, officially antisocial. I'm one day I'm going to maybe write a book about this. But I had a babysitting job with people across the street out of our cul-de-sac. So, which is basically, if you're not in the cul-de-sac, you're in a different world. And the dad of this family was a WWE wrestler. I won't mention the name.
Is he famous?
Very famous.
Is he Cena?
No.
Cena?
Very famous. But I was a very bad girl at this time. I had no consciousness, no empathy, and I stole all the time. Every time I went to babysit, I would steal from them.
This is quite a confession to make.
I'm not going to mention the name. It was a long time ago. Statute of limitations has run out. So I would steal pot from them.
You're such a bad kid.
I was like, I don't know how old I was, 16 or so, 15, 16. And I would take their door off because they had it locked.
Wait,
and I
wait,
would steal pot.
You'd actually take...
I would take it off the hinges.
You would take the door off the hinge
and steal pot from them.
That is the most desperate thing I've ever heard.
No, it's not desperate. It's fucking ingenious and resourceful. And they had so much pot.
How did you handle that? Doors are hard to balance back to get it back on.
I'm strong as fuck. Again, resourceful. I would
panic.
Steal...
Yeah.
They had so much pot that I felt totally comfortable stealing, you know, a quarter plus every time I babysat. Like, they wouldn't miss it. I'd put the door back on. But I didn't get caught for that. What I got caught for is I started getting greedy. And they had this, like, gumball machine in their house that took quarters.
Did you get in trouble?
It took quarters. Like, who has a gumball machine that takes quarters? So this thing is filled, packed, this giant thing with quarters. And I'm like, I'm going to drain that motherfucker. And that's what I got caught for, and I got fired.
How did they catch you?
Because
there was just no quarters in it one day.
There was no quarters in it one day. And I was probably like jingling as I left.
How weighted down.
Yeah, exactly.
Between the pot and the
they
quarters.
They probably weighed me in, weighed me out. Yeah. I mean, I definitely deserved
they,
to
they
get
they probably
fired.
Knew about the but, weed. It was just like, we'll let that slide.
Well,
the quarters.
They didn't report anything, which makes me think that the weed was a factor in that. Like, I never got. They never said anything about the weed. They definitely called me out on the quarters and fired me immediately.
You deserved it.
I totally deserved it. Yeah. So that's my story. And I'm sorry. I stopped stealing in my early 20s and I've never stole again. So I'm a changed person.
That's good.
But at that time, I didn't give a fuck. No empathy, completely antisocial. I didn't care. But I was a good babysitter. I mean, on the side note.
Until next time.
Do what thou wilt.
WrestleMania. Woo!